so if you could close your notes now, and well, if you really have to look, so try without the notes first, and then. Actually, you're allowed to look at the notes. So, although if you like an extra challenge, so what are these four key core concepts we've gone through the last few days, and what's a simple example of it? And I'm not looking for too much detail, just a simple example. And so what are four core concepts? And give a simple example of each. And then once you've done that, describe what a quantum computer is in 3 minutes or less. That's next year. Okay. Oh, no, there was another one. They're different. So there was another one that was... Oh, no, that wasn't one of them. The first one wasn't one of them. Mikey, see what you're...
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yes. Okay. Oh, thank you. You were good too. Yep. And give a simple example of from the notes. Just very simple. So even the way the particle duality might be like okay. There you go. John, is it? No, it's Bob. Right. You explained the point of considering three things for that. But they're not big events. Well, I mean, it's obviously by a reason, but they like it. They like to get to be strong. Okay, we might get back. We'll get back now. So hopefully that's kind of refreshed some things about quantum physics and locked it in your mind. So what we will be doing, we'll basically be closing the door on quantum physics for now, and we'll be starting on special relativity. So we'll go through till about 4:15, so 45 minutes, and then we have, did everyone read the article last night?
Yeah.
Great.
Actually, it was
Sorry?
Early this morning.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. So we have Simone Speziali, one of our researchers who is a world expert on loop quantum gravity, and we'll be talking about that, and also generally about quantum gravity, and just the idea of combining general relativity, the best theory we have of gravity, with quantum physics, which is maybe the biggest unsolved problem in physics today. That there are thousands of people around the world are working on this. This is really strongly connected with what Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life doing, it, and he didn't solve the problem. So it's hard. So does everyone have the notes for special relativity? I'll take that as a yes. Does anyone not have the notes? Okay. So core concepts of special relativity. So I guess quantum physics, or really modern physics, we've used the term modern physics, but if you look, I mean, quantum physics has been around since about 1925, so 80 years old. Special relativity, 1905, so it's over 100 years old. So modern physics is not really that new. So, but really the two core sort of pillars are two main parts to modern physics that people generally talk about. So on the one hand, you've got quantum physics, and that was developed in the first quarter of the 20th century by large numbers of scientists. There's a whole team of them. There was Niels Bohr, Einstein was there, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Dirac, Pauli, all these people, large, the so-called founding fathers. And they developed that. And really, that's in a crude way, it's the physics of the small stuff. So the atomic level, subatomic level, very, very, very tiny objects. That's quantum physics. And the other physics, in a sense, the physics of the large or the physics of gravity, the best theory we have of that is Einstein's theory of general relativity, and that's 1916. And I guess before that was special relativity. And so general relativity, well, special relativity is one special case of general relativity, so part of that, so it kind of ties in. And that's more the large scale. So general relativity is about planets, stars, black holes, galaxies, really how they move around, because gravity dominates at that large, large scale of the universe. So we have kind of the general relativity on the one hand, and quantum physics on the other hand, and kind of when you have general relativity, but you don't have any acceleration. So you're just dealing with inertial reference frames, that's really the domain of special relativity. And so you know when you teach Newtonian mechanics, and Newtonian mechanics is a theory of motion, how objects move and interact with each other, energy, momentum, and it's also about space and time. And so, same thing with special relativity. But again, very crudely speaking, special relativity applies when things are moving very fast. So in the same ballpark as the speed of light. So in some sense, special relativity, in a very, very crude sense, it's the physics of how things move when they're going very, very fast. Although that's even a bit misleading, because you know that leads students to think that, well, special relativity is just often this little corner here, and it's just dealing with velocities are so fast, only research scientists have to worry about. As far as we know, special relativity applies at all velocities, even down to a snail moving along a leaf. But just the point is, unless you get velocities are something like the 10% the speed of light or greater, then it just reduces Newtonian mechanics. We think it applies, and just the approximation of Newtonian mechanics of its own really comes into its own for high speeds. So what we'll be looking at is the two postulates of special relativity. And it's a very beautiful theory, because just two simple postulates, basically two sentences you can write down, no formulas in there, pretty much you can derive all of special relativity from that. So it's very economical. And what we're going to be doing is really introducing this idea of a really diagrammatic, pictorial, very beautiful way of understanding what's happening in special relativity. Now, it'll take a little while to develop, and you have to kind of get it and do a little bit of work. But once you get it, the payoff is huge. You can actually get a pictorial, graphical way of understanding time dilation, length contraction. You can just essentially read them off from graphs. And also the twin paradox, so really what's happening in this diagrammatic way. You can get a picture of what's happening in any other paradox, the paradox of the barn and the pole. And so it's very, very beautiful. And so hopefully by tomorrow afternoon or even by Saturday morning, we'll actually get around to doing that. So stick with me. So these things are called space-time diagrams. You've heard of those before. And really, they're plots of plotting things, events that happen in space and time. and look at this idea of a metric. A metric is the fancy term for distance. The distance between two points is given by a metric. And of course, we need to look at things from different perspectives or different reference frames, and so we need to know the rules and how to transform between different reference frames. And then, once we've got these space-time diagrams, we'll look at time dilation and length contraction, and we'll see them pictorially, visually, exactly what's happening there. And then everyone's favorite, the twin paradox. So, just some background. So, special relativity, Einstein himself said that he started the road to special relativity when he was 16 years of age, and he had a daydream about what it would be like to be riding alongside a beam of light as it was moving away from a flashlight or some artificial sort of light. He was wondering, what would he see, what would the world be like? And he didn't come up with answers then, but 10 years later, when he was 25 in 1905, he formulated special relativity. And Einstein said that that was what started him on the road to special relativity. And I actually find that, I often tell students that, because a lot of students that you teach will be 16 years of age. And just to think that at the same age they are, Einstein had this thought that triggered special relativity is I think that's a pretty amazing thing. And that that's where science comes from. He was just an incredibly curious person, and it just sprung out of the curiosity.
He was
good at math and science and all the stuff he liked, but I think back then he had to learn Latin and ancient Greek, and he wasn't really into that. And back then the German school system was very rigid, and it was about rote learning, and he was a little bit of a rebel. And so he really just did not fit in at all. I think there was one story in Latin class, he used to just sit there just completely bored and just have kind of a slight smile on his face, just sort of this vacant smile. And I think the teacher told him off for that, and then Einstein said, well, I wasn't doing anything, I was just like being silent. And the teacher, I think, said, yes, but you're undermining the discipline of the class by smiling and being disrespectful. So, okay. But one amazing thing about special relativity was that it overturned over 200 years of thinking about space and time. It completely changes our idea what space and time are, and is this incredibly fundamental thing. I mean, we're aware of time every single second of our waking lives. We're always aware of where we are in space. It is a fundamental building blocks of our physical universe. And up until then, Isaac Newton's theories of space and time dominated. And absolute space and absolute time, you can change those. And it also had a cultural impact. It sort of shifted over to art. A number of artists were actually inspired and motivated by this idea that, well, they took it to be that everything is relative and used that. And so that's theory about space, time, and motion, and what happens to these things as relative velocities change. And one important part, special relativity, is only deals with constant velocities. So we're not talking about things that are speeding up or slowing down or otherwise accelerating. It's just constant velocity. That's one important caveat. So what we'd like to hear now is, I actually have a little audio clip of the man himself, Einstein, speaking about E=mc², but something a little bit different, but that's part of special relativity. It's a little bit hard because he has sort of a thick German accent, but this is a text we'll read out, but just to give you kind of a better sense of the man himself. We will put that on now for you. Okay.
Entanglement,
yes. Oh. So eventually, okay. So this is, hopefully this will work.
It follows from the special theory of relativity that mass and energy are both but different manifestations of the same thing, a somewhat unfamiliar conception for the average mind. Furthermore, the equation E=mc², in which energy is put equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, shows that very small amounts of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa. maximum is energy where in fact equivalent. According to the formula mentioned above, this was demonstrated by Kostra and Boyton in 1932 experiment.
What was the experiment? I'm not sure, actually. Good question.
I don't. I think they split a carbon atom.
Okay.
It was a low mass. It was no low mass fission.
Okay. Okay. So. Special relativity. So these are the two postulates of the two starting points. And pretty much everything in special relativity follows from just those two things. So the first one, the relativity postulate, that is the laws of physics are the same in all inertial reference frames. And the speed of light postulate that light travels in a vacuum or through empty space at a constant speed of 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second to all relative to all inertial observers from all perspectives. And so the question comes up. Actually, I should just mention with the speed of light, so you know the speed of light is incredibly, incredibly fast. And even the fastest military jet plane we have would not even move at 1% the speed of light. So if you could travel at the speed of light, then you could circle the entire globe at the equator around about 7 times every second. So it's a very hard speed to kind of get your head around just how fast the speed of light is. And the reason, of course, well, we don't see time dilation in every life. We don't see buses contracting. It's just we're around this tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the velocity of the speed of light. And so relativistic effects, they're there. And you can test, well, so in principle you can test them, but they're just very, very minuscule. So they're a millionth of a percent. So we don't actually see them. So, but we do have... So certainly in the universe there are a number of distant galaxies or stars that are moving away or towards us with relative velocities close to the speed of light, and you can definitely see relativistic effects with those. And also the other thing is with particle accelerators. You can get electrons in those up to, I think it's something like 99.999% the speed of light, so such as the ones at CERN. These huge underground rings with massive magnets, they speed up electrons, protons, and so forth. And there, they actually do experiments with relativity, and they actually see these effects, and they actually have to use relativity, and they see time dilation, for example. Question up the back?
Yeah, I don't have a degree, as I said earlier, but when you say inertial frame, one of those constant velocities.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if an object is moving at half speed of light.
Right.
Constant velocity.
Yep.
Speed of light to that person is not 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second.
No, it is c. It is the full speed of light, which is very strange, and we'll see an example of that in a minute. So it's incredibly counterintuitive. It's hard to come up with a intuitive explanation for so two things about it. That was one of the starting points of Einstein's postulates or special relativity. But again, I'll talk about one experiment that people have done. But people have done experiments basically similar to what you're talking about, and they have seen light. Actually, even if you're going at half the speed of light or 99% the speed of light still travels relative to you at c. And this is a very strange thing, but it is a lot overwhelming experimental evidence for it. So we'll talk about that in a minute. So an inertial frame is one without any acceleration. And operationally you can find it, or practically you can find it, by it's where Newton's first law holds. That if you put a little test particle or any objects in your frame, bodies that are moving either at a constant velocity or they're at rest, then they stay at that constant velocity or they stay at rest unless some external forces acting on them. In non-inertial reference frames, what you find essentially is that things spontaneously accelerate without any cause without any force. And when you know that's happening, you know that's caused by you were actually accelerating yourself. So you're just seeing things from this non-inertial perspective. Yes?
Do astronomers, when they're observing stars, consider the relative effects of the Earth around the Sun and around the universe, like their own gravitation?
Yeah, correct. So if you look at it on a large enough scale, then we're not. So the idea of an inertial reference frame that extends on forever and ever and ever in space and in time is a theoretical fiction. It does not exist. So if you're doing experiments in a room, then we can consider the Earth to be an inertial reference frame on a scale of galaxies. Then no, you can't. So certainly, I mean, it would depend on what sort of experiment they were doing, but certainly on a number of experiments, astronomers do use and take into account relativity and the relativistic effects of essentially, definitely of the light and Doppler shifts of stars moving away towards us. And there's a lot of very detailed things they take into account, just our relative motion. So in a lot of experiments, absolutely. Because when you get up to a high speed, you can't get Newtonian mechanics. So, yes?
Actually, if you consider the orbit of, say, Mercury, and you, for example, we already have hundreds of years of observational data.
Yeah.
And actually, we can detect the difference between the prediction of classical mechanics and Einstein's theory of relativity.
Yeah, so that's the advance of perihelion of Mercury.
It doesn't have to involve high speed or things like that. And astronomers actually can do it.
Yeah, sure, that's general relativity, but good point, yeah. So the relativity postulate, so the first one. So what that's really meaning is that physics should be universal and democratic, that there shouldn't be anything special or privileged about my reference frame or your reference frame. And it's only if you're in the Earth reference frame or one particular reference frame that you can use Newtonian mechanics. Any inertial reference frame, whether it's out in deep space or it's on another planet, the laws of physics should apply everywhere throughout the universe. So it's very, it's kind of a leveler in that sense. And so in 1905, it was both very revolutionary and also it had been predated. So Galileo in the 17th century had his own relativity postulate, except it was different to Einstein. He said that the laws of mechanics are the same in all inertial reference frames. So it's not all the laws of physics, there's a subtle difference there. And so there was this, and Einstein knew about this, he'd been around for over 200 years. But what Einstein did was revolutionary, was he actually broadened mechanics to include all the physics. And he did that even though he knew that, and part of the genius was to know, to believe in that, because he knew that if he had applied that, then the laws of physics included the laws of electricity and magnetism, electromagnetism, Maxwell's equations. But he knew that if he actually did apply it to all inertial observers, that would have very, very radical consequences. And, for example, he knew that it implied that the speed of light was independent of the velocity of an observer relative to the source of the speed of light. And so, but he essentially had enough guts to believe in that, to follow his convictions and really to see his radical program through. And then, and to actually back, and that led to special relativity. So, one view of the relativity postulate. So imagine you wake up one morning, and you find yourself in a strange room, you don't know where you are, you don't know how you got there. And a strange man and a strange woman walk up to you and say, you've been kidnapped, but we'll let you go if you can tell us between the two options that I'm about to present to you now. And that is, one, if you can tell us whether the room is fixed to the ground and it's actually stationary with respect to it, or the room is actually completely encased inside a plane and the room doesn't have any, it's black, there are no windows, you can't see out. If the room is inside a plane, flying at a very, very low altitude, at a constant velocity with respect to the Earth. And you have to decide between those two things. You only have a couple of minutes to do that, a very short period of time. But he says, well, or they say, well, we know you're a physics teacher, so what we'll do is we'll allow you any physics experiment you like, as long as you just use information within the room. You can't call a friend outside or anything like that. You can just do experiments within the room. And they pull back a curtain, and there's an array of multimeters and kinds of devices, linear air tracks and stuff like that. There's this amazing smorgasbord of physics experiments. And you say, okay, you do anything you like. You don't have all day, you've just got a couple of minutes. And what the relativity postulate says is there's no way to reliably distinguish between those two possibilities, no matter what equipment you have. And the reason for that is if the laws of physics are the same in all inertial reference frames, whether you're stationary and with respect to Earth, you're moving at a constant velocity relative to it, then every single experiment you're going to do is going to produce the same outcome. And so basically, there's no way to reliably so you can guess. You get it right. Yes?
What about the fact that you'd be moving through the Earth's magnetic fields? The magnetic field would be changing.
Ooh.
Sorry?
If you're in the plane, you're moving through the Earth's magnetic field, so you might be able to measure its changes.
No, but that's slowly the metal shell that...
That's a good point. I have to think about that. So you're moving... I'm not sure if you would be able to do that. I'd have to think about that one, but I'm not sure if you...
But that would be...
North Pole would be...
Magnetic variations change.
Would be moving as you circumcise the Earth.
Right, but if you only do it for a few minutes.
And so you measure arc seconds of change.
Right, yeah. But see, I mean if you wait for a long enough amount of time then you can. But what this is, so basically every example you think like this, you can always think of some way. But that's just sort of really the idea of an inertial reference frame that extends forever in time and forever in space is just it's like theoretical fiction, if you like, but it's very useful. So that's the relativity postulate, and that's what that says. So moving on to the next postulate, the speed of light postulate, and very, very crudely speaking, that says that everyone measures the speed of light to be c, to travel at c. And that's somewhat very, very counterintuitive as the question from the back came. So what I'd like to do is just run through a couple of examples of that and just seeing how strange it is. But again, I'll show you this is I've done experiments, and I've actually verified this. So imagine that you're tobogganing, it's winter, it's very snowy, there's a hill there, you toboggan down this hill, you're in a flat area there, and you're traveling at, got up a bit of speed with a group of friends, and you're up at 30 kilometers per hour. Actually, no, your friends are. So your friends there, they're traveling 30 kilometers per hour relative to you, and then they have some snow, they pick up some snow, and decide to have some fun. So they throw a snowball at you. And the snowball leaves them, so it's moving away from your friends in the toboggan at 15 kilometers per hour. So that's the relative speed of the snowball with respect to the toboggan. So the question is, and this is something I do with students, is what is the speed where you see the snowball rushing towards you? So that's you there. So what speed will you see the snowball moving towards you at? So I know you know the answer, but just in the spirit of interactivity, it's not meant to be a trick question, like there are some bizarre quantum computer effects that take over here. But if you could just write down the answer and then show it up on the card, just to illustrate the technique. So what speed will you see?
You're from Australia. How did you know that? Yeah.
Okay, so lots of A's. Yep. Great. Okay. Great. So, if I could have your attention. So what we're going to do is just change it very slightly. Just make a little change here. let's get rid of the snowball and replace it by a photon. So in a sense, they throw a single photon. Maybe they just have a single photon laser. Somehow they just produced a single photon or a little burst of light. And that light obviously travels away to your friends, so the speed of it relative to them is c, because everyone measures the speed of light to be c. So if you turn on a laser pointer, there are lots of millions of photons in there, they move away from me at c. Exactly the same thing for your friends on the toboggan. So that's the photon there, that's the speed of it, c. So the question is, what speed do you see the photon travelling towards you at? So what's the speed of the photon relative towards you? So the options, you can see the options there. C, C plus 30 kilometers per hour, C minus 30 kilometers per hour, or C divided by 30 kilometers per hour. So again, I know a lot of you know the answer. I'll just give you 30 seconds. And while you're thinking about that, maybe think about what misconceptions might lead students to come up with the three erroneous answers. So I'll give you 2 minutes. Okay, that's enough time. If everyone could. So, yep, fantastic. Great. So, just two more. I'd like to change it just slightly again. Let's make it, instead of 30 kilometers per hour, the incredibly realistic value of 100,000 kilometers per second. So a third of the speed of light. So your friend is traveling in a toboggan, they have a jet-powered toboggan, super-duper jet-powered, alien technology, and moving 100,000 kilometers per second. What will, keeping everything exactly the same, what speed will you see the light traveling towards you at? So, I'll give you 1 minute again and discuss what misconceptions might lead students to come up with the wrong answer. So, short amount of time now, 1 minute. But I've done this for students a number of times, and I have sometimes their answers change. Yeah. Well, some, not a lot, but there's a non-trivial number to do that. Because I think it's yeah. But even if they don't see, even if their answer is the same, it still helps to reinforce the fact that it doesn't matter what how much your RAM can speed up. So, okay, can everyone hold their answers up? Now. Yes, great. Okay, one last change. We're going to get rid of the toboggan, we've had that for a while now, and replace that with a subatomic particle. And a plate with a subatomic particle. And let's just, for concrete, let's make it one particular type. And this is a pion, a neutral pion. And if we do that and we make the speed of the pion 99.9% the speed of light, then essentially the setup we have is exactly the same as an experiment. A real experiment was done in CERN in 1964. This is a reference for it. Although the photon they had, that was actually in sort of in the gamma ray frequency, so a very, very high frequency range. So we have a photon here, we have this, and then, so what's everyone's answers now? So write down your answers. So I know you know the answer to this, but well, just again, so could everyone, yep? Yes, yeah, actually the pion is emitting the photon, so exactly like your friends in the toboggan throwing it out. Yes, John?
Oh, just a quick, so pion does decay in a photon to get it? Or is this a makeup? Is this a makeup? Like, does a pion decay and emit a photon?
So the details, I'm not sure if it decays, I think it just emits a photon without decaying, decreases in energy.
Okay, so a photon is emitted by a...
Yeah, I think that's the way the experiment... I have to check the details, but I think that's it. So... Yes?
How do they measure the speed of the photon?
How do they measure the speed of the photon? What they probably did, a lot of the ways they actually use interferometers. So it's hard to actually measure a long distance as photons travel so fast. But they had a sequence of errors where both the light just bounces back and forth and back and forth. And they do it that way. Yeah. And often they get two different arms, photons traveling down two different lengths of arms in two different directions, and how they recombine and interfere with each other itself in that. Okay, so the strange thing is, I saw a lot of A's there, that the answer is actually A for that one. So that... Even though in some sense the photon has a boost of 99.9% the speed of light as a result of coming in from the pion there, that makes zero difference the speed that you measure it coming towards you at. So the naive answer, I mean, if you went to a shopping center and basically went up to random people and surveyed them, most people would say, pretty much everyone would say, it should be coming out and just add the two velocities. That's exactly what you do. In the previous case, you would get 199.9% speed of light that the photon, the light's rushing towards you at. But it's possible. That's faster than the speed of light. So Einstein says you can't have that. So what we're seeing is, yes, very quickly.
I think a really good example of the counterintuitive nature of this would be to ask students now, if the observer sees it at sea,
right,
what speed does the pilot see it recess or run at?
Right, okay, yeah. Actually, someone mentioned that last week, so yeah, that would be, okay, that would be a good thing to add on.
Because you get a lot of people saying 0.1% of speed.
Right, okay, yeah. Okay, that's a good point. So yeah, actually I haven't done that, but I could add that. Yeah, good point. So we're seeing a breakdown of the standard law of addition of velocities. The law that we use just add the two velocities because we've just got a linear example of 30 plus 15 to give you 45, that breaks down. That does not work. And so we need a new relativistic law of addition of velocities. But what's actually we're seeing happening here is that something very strange is happening with space, something very, very strange is happening with the speed of light. And incredibly well verified. And if something strange is happening with the speed of light, well, you measure speed as distance divided by time, meters divided by seconds in SI units. So if something strange is happening with the speed of light, then that suggests that something very, very strange is happening with space and time. And that is indeed the case. And just from the two postulates of relativity alone, you can derive and know that time dilation, that if something is moving away from you or relative to you at a really, really, really fast velocity, then you see its time is slowed down. Time, from your perspective, really does slow down. in that reference frame. And also that when an object is moving past you very, very quickly, it actually compresses or shrinks down length contraction. So it goes bizarre, bizarre things. And so really just from these two economical postulates, and just to show you very quickly, exactly kind of an illustration of really some of the strange things that occur with space and time getting mixed up with each other. What I'll show you now is simulation. Actually, we'll see more of this on Saturday morning, but I'll show you a simulation of exactly what the tram would look like if it was rushing past you at 87% the speed of light. And you can actually see length contraction here. So, take a little while. But this is through Einstein's eyes, and this is a series of simulations. And we've got copies to give out to you, so we'll do that in a couple of days. But very quickly, what you see... So this is something a group of physicists in Australia did up, and used a lot of supercomputer time to actually very precisely calculate what you would see if you were traveling close to the speed of light. So this is...
Is it slowed down so you can see it?
Yeah, it is. And so, over the course of my job, I've probably gone out to a number of schools, about 20 to 30 schools, and whenever I talk about special relativity, I always do this. Kids love this. They think they're not learning, it's fun. And when I do my evaluations, pretty much consistently, this comes out to be the number one thing that they actually like, the movie they wanted the roller coaster to see on Saturday. I think the thing that I like the least is we actually get them to do some work and actually some calculations. You don't always want to be the most popular teacher. So we'll start here. Let's go to tram. And so again, this is really what you would see. So there are a number of effects. There's some text down there, but again, I'll just show you quickly, then we'll go through this just to whet your appetite on Saturday. This is following on from the two postulates, especially about space and time. I prefer to do that on Saturday. Essentially, the main reason for a lot of those, for that effect is the finite speed of light. And you're actually seeing, the finite speed of light. So you actually see light that reflected off the back of it, parts you normally don't see. So, is that okay if I defer further questions on that? Okay, defer. Okay, so focus, right. So, space-time diagrams, okay. So by the end of Saturday, space-time diagrams will be your new friends. That's my goal, and you will love them. So, what we'd like to do is consider the following three unrelated happenings or events. So a happening is just something that occurs at one particular time and at one particular place. And we call that an event. That's a technical term we use. So, consider the following. An apple falls from a tree. Let's call that event A, or happening A. A bird takes flight from a tree. Call that happening A, or happening B, or event B. And a car comes to a stop at a set of traffic lights. Call that event C. And they all happen again at a particular location, at a particular time. So what's very natural to do is to plot them on it graphically or on a graph which with space and time axes. And so assume that they all happen in kind of a line, so all in one dimension. So what we really have to look at just the location of them happening, we might have x-axis here, we have A, B, and C. So what we have to have is all in one line, but that doesn't show the time, so we really want to show the space and the time. So we could plot it on a graph here, and by convention what we do, there's no reason we had to do this, we actually plot space or x on the horizontal axis, and then time on the vertical axis. So it's kind of a bit different, it's the opposite way around to plots you might have of displacement versus time or velocity versus time in Newtonian mechanics, but perhaps this is good to distinguish between the two. So this is a space-time diagram, this is special relativity, and just remember, just it's convention. So basically, I think it was Herman Minkowski in about 1910 that actually invented these, and I think he just decided, hey, let's put time in the vertical axis. And to my mind, it kind of makes sense to get the kind of time as flowing up vertically. So this is what we might have, just to put all these events, mark out where they occur in space and time.
What's the reference points for the origin?
Roughly reference points for the origin. It could be anything. It could, you could pick a rock, a tree. It could be anything. So whatever you want. Yeah, you have to pick some sort of reference point. But absolutely, yeah, to fix your origin. So what we do, and so such a graph is, we call it a space and time diagram, and we actually kind of merge space and time in together, and then call that a space-time diagram. So space-time. So in special relativity, there's no fundamental distinction between space and time. And in fact, what I see, what we see from our reference frame as being space, another observer, someone else, an alien, a group of Klingons going past in a spaceship at 99% the speed of light, they will see that actually as a mixture of space and time. So space and time actually get mixed up. So there's no, again, sort of fundamental divide between them. And so to kind of mirror that, we kind of blur the word space and time into one word, space-time. And Minkowski himself said that henceforth space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind of union of the two will preserve an independent reality. And it's actually interesting, Minkowski, he was a university teacher of Einstein when at university. And Einstein, he was very, very independent, very rebellious, and so often didn't study that hard on the actual university exams and the standard curriculum that he used to do. And so Minkowski actually had him as a student and wasn't too impressed by that. At one stage, I think, called Einstein a lazy dog and said that it would never amount to anything. I guess he was wrong. So, what do a series of events look like on a space-time diagram? So, for example, we have a car driving along at 60 kilometers per hour in one direction on a highway. So if we think about that, so it's obviously going forwards in time, so all we could draw dots that are going upwards. And it's obviously moving along, so let's say it's going in the positive x direction, the positive space direction. What it's doing is that it's moving further and further and further and further across all the time. And so as a result, what it looks like, we draw all sequence of events, they form a line that kind of goes up and to the right. And if we want to be technically, we can call that's a line representing all the events in kind of the world of the electron, and it's a line, so we call it a world line. So, okay, it's just before the break, some activity for you. So what I'd like you to do now is to draw some space-time diagrams. So to get the whiteboards out. And there are three examples there. A car driving 100 kilometers per hour in one direction, turns around, drives in the other direction. A grade 12 physics student waiting for a bus, an Olympic athlete running at a constant velocity in a 100 meter race. And this one, a little bit tricky. It's hard to get the representation right, but a car driving around in circles. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So you're born.
All right.
You know, it's getting closer to it and stuff.
That's going to be the hardest thing to do is to go to the place to actually go. Well, because it was convention, time's increasing.
So pretty much everyone has it right. So the last one's kind of hard, but it's hard to get, but we imagine just in space on X, Y, you might imagine the circle, the car going around, that's what it traces out in space. but we've got a time axis kind of going up here, so it's kind of going around here, but it's all continually going upwards. So what it creates is really a spiral or corkscrew pattern like something like that. So it's kind of actually, it's not very clear. So that's it. Great. So it looks like everyone's on top of those. So what we will do now is we'll take a coffee break. We're going for about an hour and 20 minutes. So if everyone could be very quick to be back here just after 10:30, because we have another keynote presentation on quantum gravity 101. So back here in just 4 minutes.
Oh, I got set to like 5 minutes over. I don't know very many things. Yeah, it's the program. Yeah, it's the program. It's the right program.